You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host.
Today is the last of a two-part interview with Ambassador Alfonso E. Lenhart. I encourage you to listen to the first episode if you missed it. During that segment, we discussed the powerful influence of the ambassador's mother, which set the stage for him during his formative years for him to place others before himself. The ambassador also gave us a very special look inside his 31-year career in the United States Army, with special emphasis on how he was able to sidestep racial bias on his way to increasing levels of responsibility and service, concluding with his rank of Major General. He also shares lessons for other sectors about how they can emulate the transformation of the Army into one of the most diverse and inclusive institutions in our country. During this episode, we will cover the impressive work the ambassador conducted outside of the military. Ambassador, you've had a tremendous opportunity to serve outside of the military. One of those places was at the Council on Foundations, and I'm so curious how you ended up at the Council on Foundations, your first job out of the military.
Great story. I wanted to do something when I retired in 1997 after 31 years in the Army. I wanted to do something totally different from what I had been doing in the military. I wanted to broaden my horizons, but I also wanted to figure out ways that I can continue to serve not only our country, but potentially the world. I have to tell you that the first time I met Dot Ridings, who was the CEO, and my name came up as a potential select for the position, she said no, because she thought that a general would certainly have certain attitudes and take certain positions with respect to how he would operate. But I invited her to lunch, and I said, after a nice, very conversation we had, "Does it work for you?" And she looked at me, she says, "It worked for me." And so I was hired right there on the spot. So that's how I came to the Council on Foundations as the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer.
I suspect she had no idea that a person who had led in a pretty top-down situation that we have come to understand the military to be in the past could actually work in a more, I would say, humane, as some people might say, sector. But I guess she was surprised to find out that she really had someone who was really more focused on service than self.
Exactly. That was my focus. And the other thing, too, I'll add, is that the military is not nearly as top down as you might think. The military pushes responsibility, pushes authority down to the lowest level to get the job done. And so the military is really more of a matrix organization. And so that's what I brought to the equation at the Council on Foundations. And of course, the whole notion of service and commitment and doing things that are beyond oneself is something that I brought to the Council on Foundations as well.
What did you find there, and how do you feel that your experience was able to help guide that work?
Well, I found a very welcoming community, philanthropy. I found people who were equally as dedicated and who worked hard at the task, as I found in the military. I found patriots who cared about people around the world. I thought in a rather close way that I would never encounter again the kind of camaraderie, commitment to service, dedication to whatever it was that we were doing that I found in the military. And in fact, I found that in the philanthropic sector as well. And again, I get back to my readings and thinking about de Tocqueville and others. It didn't, as I thought about it, didn't surprise me nearly as much once I thought about who the people were who were in fact in philanthropy.
Yeah, and you had a chance to interact with some pretty amazing people who run some very large philanthropies who were members of that organization. Places like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and CERDNA, and the Rockefeller Foundation. I could name a long list. These are all people who are very focused, I think, on seeing society move forward in different ways and putting large amounts of money into organizations to do it. And I would suspect, though, even with that, it wasn't always easy to keep these organizations working together. And I know that was one of the goals and aims of the Council on Foundations.
Well, it was the Council on Foundation, as you know, is a membership organization made up of, at the time, well over 2,200 member foundations, private foundations, family giving programs of one description or another, community foundations, corporate grant-making foundations. And so they were all different, and they had their different areas of focus. But I will say, on the whole, I found the same commitment. I found the same sense of dedication. I found the same sense of wanting to make a difference, not only in American society, but the world in general. And so it was that I saw as the commonality from what I had experienced in the military that very easily crosswalked to the philanthropic sector. And so I felt very good about that. And though they were different, they all had the same sense of service, the same sense of making a difference in the world, the same sense of improving the human condition and benefiting the planet. So as much as they were different, they were very similar in terms of their purpose and their intent.
Now, I have to tell this story about how you left the Council on Foundations. I suspect you thought you'd be there maybe a bit longer after having such a good time and good entry. But it wasn't long before the government called again for you to take on the responsibility as being our sergeant at arms for the United States Senate. And I have to laugh when I ask you this. What was your expectation when you went into the job? And how different was that once you got into the job?
Yeah. I was at the Council on Foundations for 4 years, and I was quite happy. And we were doing a number of things in Dud Ridings, and the team had a very good focus on the philanthropic sector and what we were doing and the contributions being made by the various giving programs. I was counseled by a number of friends, mentors, my family members, to take the job at the in the Senate. Although it was a significant reduction in salary, but salary was never the thing that drove me anyway. But what they wanted me to certainly make a mark is that the Sergeant-at-Arms of the Senate, for the 237-year history of the country, had never had an African-American as a member of an officer in the Senate. So I was the first Black sergeant-at-arms in either House or Senate. and the first officer of the Congress, black officer of the Congress. And so I was appointed on the 4th of September, 2001, 9/11. And 9/11 followed a week later, and I found myself embroiled in protecting the Senate, protecting the Capitol against possible threats. And of course, as you know, on the 15th of October of the same year, we had the anthrax incident, which was the world, in fact, it's still the largest bioterrorism incident in the history of our country. And so we had to deal with that, remediate significant portions of the of Capitol Hill, and return it to a normal condition sufficient for people to continue to work. And so that required shutting down buildings and doing a host of testing and fumigation of facilities and the like, and training programs. And so those first few months of my tenure as a sergeant at arms were certainly a challenge, but it was one that, again, my preparation as an Army officer and the things that I learned in the Army was able to crosswalk to my position in the Senate and on Capitol Hill, because I also oversaw much of the work being done in the House as well. So we looked at the entire Capitol Hill, and we also did work with the Supreme Court and obviously the Library of Congress in terms of protecting all those vital facilities and organizations that are so important to our government, and all of which is designed to continue government as we understand it and functioning of the legislative branch.
Well, I can only say that I have no idea, and most people will have no understanding of what it took to keep those buildings safe and to strengthen the security around them during that time. But I will say I had a brief glimpse of what it might have been like when I came to visit you once to have lunch with you at the Senate dining room. It's an honor that I'll never forget. And we sit down for lunch and make our order. And then about 5 minutes later, I think you had a pager go off and two phones both go off at the same time. And I felt so guilty being there, taking you away from this really important work. But you were gracious enough to kind of sit through lunch with me. And I appreciate that. But it gave me a sense of what you were dealing with and how heroic, really, and fortuitous for our country that you were available and called to service at that time. It's almost as if the heavens knew that we needed a special individual to take over that role, and you were asked to do it, even though I know that there's no way you could have anticipated having to do it under those circumstances. It was, for most of those 237 years, I'm sure, a much more ceremonious role. But when you got there, it became something very different. And thank God you were around to make it, to do it and get it through. So I always think of you in heroic terms when I think of you taking over that job as sergeant at arms of the Senate. If you don't mind me asking, and I know you don't take compliments very well, so I'll stop, but if you don't mind me asking, when you finally left that job, you were then back in the nonprofit sector, which I'm happy to say, with an organization that had a legacy brand, but that was probably not as visible as it had once been. And that was the National Crime Prevention Council. And we see this from time to time with organizations that had been around for some time. And I'm sure they thought you might be someone to help revitalize that organization. What did you find there, and how were you able to help it progress?
Well, at the National Crime Prevention Council was a wonderful organization, and the beloved icon for the National Crime Prevention Council is McGruff the Crime Dog.
Mm-hmm.
Take a bite out of crime. And so the mission, the intent, and the focus of the National Crime Prevention Council is to teach, train communities how to protect themselves in concert with police agencies in the community. Everything from community policing to citizen patrols, neighborhood watch. And so it was the kind of opportunity, again, to pass back, to reach back and provide service to the community. I go back to my mother and her teachings, and I quickly tell you that that's the one thing, as it was, and I was recruited for that job, by the way. And the hook was to provide service to the country. And of course, to a soldier, to a professional soldier trained in the ways that of leadership and what we could look to in terms of service, something that's larger than oneself, those were magical words. And I was with the council, the National Crime Prevention Council, for 5 years. And we made some big strides in trying to resurrect what at that point was a bit moribund, the image of the National Crime Prevention Council and McGruff the Crime Dog. And so we re-energized the organization to reach out and do more. And we worked very closely with police agencies across the country. There are some well over 18,000 various police agencies or sheriff department or law enforcement institutions in our country. And that's a lot. And so our effort was to train, provide necessary counseling to citizens, to bring about neighborhood watch programs of one description or another. I will tell you that I spent as much time on the road with the National Crime Prevention Council as I did in any other job, to include the work I did in Army recruiting and other areas. I spent a lot of time out in the field. And I will tell you again, I found people, community at the community level, at the state level, who are as equally dedicated to helping reduce crime in America. At one point, towards the end of my tour with the National Crime Prevention Council, we started to reach out to international organizations to include things like Interpol, looking at countries in Latin America, looking at countries in Eastern Europe, where we could train and provide teaching opportunities to those countries that they would come up with prevention programs in their communities.
It would have been very interesting to see you in that role today, given the challenges that we're seeing with police forces and citizens. I just hope that this organization can be stood up in a way that can play a role to help bring about true understanding so that we can all be better.
Well, that was the focus. It really is about a couple of things. Recruitment, selection, and training. And if I can harp on those three points and a mantra, I will tell you that it makes all the difference in the world. Recruit the right people, for the right job, select the right people at the time that you are looking to fill the ranks, wherever it may be, and then ensure that you train and have adequate retraining events so that you continually monitor the success that you expect. Police and police forces and the people that make them up are just like anybody else. You have to continually evaluate, assess where you are, make improvements that are required where they may be required, and ensure that you continue to grow and you don't forget service, service above all.
Amen to that. Ambassador, it wasn't long after President Obama took office that the administration came knocking on your door yet again to serve our government, this time as a diplomat. And you were asked to take on the role as ambassador to Tanzania. And I have had an opportunity to visit Tanzania many years ago and found the people to be just amazingly high-spirited and positive, even though many of them live in conditions that don't even compare in quality to some of the worst conditions we have here. But their attitudes were just so inspiring and uplifting. I don't know if you knew that when you took the role as ambassador to Tanzania, but I'm sure you found it when you were there. Tell us about your experience. You moved your wife there, and tell us about your experience living among the Tanzanian people and representing our government.
Well, I will tell you that that opportunity to serve as ambassador to Tanzania as the personal representative of our president, President Barack Obama, was a highlight of my career. And so it was one that I found to be most rewarding, working with the Tanzanian people, who are wonderful people, who have the greatest attitude about life, who have a zest for life. You know, I say it was a highlight of my career because, in fact, everything that I had learned and the things that I had hoped to impart, I was able to use in Tanzania, namely service to a higher calling, something that was larger than anything that I had done in my career, and the service to the people of Tanzania, bringing the American people's desire to help them, was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. The Tanzanian people are by nature loving, they're friendly, they care very much about their families. And the one thing that I would say in terms of what the United States was able to do, what America was able to do, is to reach out to the Tanzanian people. The American people reaching out to the Tanzanian people to help them grow, to nurture them in terms of opportunities for them to do more in their lives, to develop their society in the areas of health, the areas of food security, the areas of clean water, the environment. We had a great opportunity to lower the incidence of HIV/AIDS, which when I got there was in fact a major problem, that we were able to significantly reduce the incidence of HIV/AIDS in Tanzania. And so across the board, the American people reaching out to the Tanzanian people made tremendous strides. Infant mortality rates were cut to levels that were unheard of, unthinkable in a country like Tanzania, with its poverty level and certainly its, in many ways, meager health systems. We also helped them with their democracy We help them develop the systems and the approaches from the standpoint of their legislative undertakings as well as their judicial application. They modeled many of our institutions there in Tanzania. You know, part of what when Tanzania was established as a independent country, the first decade, over a decade, they were socialist. And so there were a number of systems that, when I got there, was still mired in the old practices. So we had to bring them forward into the 21st century. I was there for 4 years, and I like to think that they were four of the most rewarding years of my life in terms of our contributions. But the theme throughout my tenure and that which we were able to pass on to my successor was the American people reaching out to the Tanzanian people. We found that approach to be highly useful, understandable from the standpoint of the people of Tanzania, where they could relate to the American people reaching out to the Tanzanian people. And so everything that we undertook had that as a theme. So water projects, construction projects of one description or another, health programs, everything from inoculation to bringing people the opportunity to be able to see better. As an example, we brought ophthalmologists from the Department of Defense to Tanzania once a year. And then when I first got there, my first year, and then we started bringing them there quarterly. The number of Tanzanian people who were able to have their eyesight improved, where they could go to school, where they could learn. The children would be able to use facilities that otherwise they couldn't begin to understand. Children were in school. So it was the kind of thing where working in hand with USAID, and that's how the connection between the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development worked very closely to bring about programs that improved the lives of the Tanzanian people. Every time I think of that experience, it's one that I'm warmed by, and I still have a number of Tanzanian friends that I'm in contact with. And so my wife and I think about those 4 years with great admiration for the Tanzanian people, and have great nostalgia about in terms of our lives.
Well, when you came home, somehow you ended up at the United States Agency for International Development. And I don't think I quite heard how that happened.
Again, I was recruited. When I came back, I had several friends. I was going to go into retirement, quote unquote, and I was approached saying, well, we have another thing that we'd like you to do. And so, again, you know, the old hook, service to country. And so I agreed to become the deputy of the U.S. Agency for International Development. I went through the nomination process again and confirmation by the Senate. When I got to the organization, it was a couple of months, and then the administrator at the time decided that he would leave, and so I became the acting administrator.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was one where, again, you know, we're back at it, and one of the major undertakings, efforts we had was Ebola. Trying to ensure that the incidence of Ebola in the three countries in Africa did not find, the disease did not find its way to the United States. And so much of the work that we undertook in Africa, you know, was designed to ensure that we eradicated Ebola in Africa so that it would not be communicated across the world. It was contained there. And in the United States, we did have but two cases where people died as a result of Ebola, who had been in Africa, and they were quickly identified in the United States, quarantined, put under medical attention for a period of time, and unfortunately we couldn't save them, but we did ensure that Ebola was not the kind of pandemic that would have destroyed, killed people many times over. So that was one example, but I will also share with you that the United States Agency for International Development works around the globe, helping people, holding back food insecurity, improving conditions for people to live, to survive in environments that, quite frankly, are unlike anything that most people would understand. The challenges that people around the world live with every day. The challenge is to remain alive for many people. And the U.S. Agency for International Development works mightily trying to help those people around the world. The agency's budget is significant when you think about it, but it equates to about 0.6% of our national budget, which is a drop in a bucket. But the good that we do throughout the world inures the kind of return and goodness and appreciation and respect for our country beyond anything that we spend monetarily.
Well, looking at your career, I can certainly see how you were tapped for many of these posts. You had certainly the experience at the Council on Foundations, so you understood grant making, and the United States Agency for International Development is the largest grant making organization in the world. So you were right there. There's a security element to it, which you're obviously familiar with. And there's obviously a diplomatic aspect to the work at the USAID and a health aspect. So clearly all of these different positions that you held throughout your life prepared you for the jobs that you were situated in. And I have to look at this from the standpoint of young people coming along, trying to sew a career together. I'm sure you couldn't have sat down and said, this is what I'm going to do now. This is what I'm going to do next. This is what I'm going to do next. And it's all going to make sense. And it's all going to weave itself together. So what do we tell young people? What do we tell them to focus on?
That's a great question. It's a question I get often from young people at a time when I'm either coaching them for various things or a number of people I mentor. And it's one where I simply tell them what my mother told me many, many years ago. And I mentioned it earlier in one of our segments, bloom wherever planted. Do the best you can wherever you might find yourself. And in order to be able to do that, you have first to be able to prepare yourself for opportunities yet unknown that may come your way, will come your way. And so preparation, hard work, when opportunities arise, you are able to step up to it. And it's never about oneself. It's all about how you can do more for other people. If you have that as your underpinning, you can't help but to be successful, whatever it is that you undertake. And the success doesn't have to be as observable to other people as much as the success you feel internally, how you feel in terms of your motivation, your spirit. And so that's something, again, I hearken back to my mother.
In our first episode, you were really generous in speaking about the influence that your mother had on your upbringing and your development as a person really focused on doing more for others than self. And I couldn't help but ask to close out this second episode, what you would say to your mother if she were here, and what would she say to you about the man that you've become?
I think that my mother would say that she was happy that I was following her edicts and her maxims that she laid out for me and my siblings in our formative years. And I would hope that she's proud of me. But I will tell you that Mom was very exacting, and so she would always talk about continuing to improve. And so it would be a good news report that Mom would give, but she would still say there is more to do, because she was just that kind of a person who was always looking forward. With Mom, the glass is always half full as opposed to half empty. And so she would put on our shoulders the responsibility, the obligation to continue service.
Continue to fill that glass.
Indeed. And that's just the way Mom was. It was never, and it was always gentle. We called her the velvet hammer because she was very soft in her approach, but she was made of steel. And she had a just unrelenting desire for her children to do more in the world and for all of us to impress upon our children and future generations to do as much as we could to give back.
So what would you say to her?
I would say, Mom, I'm continuing to try and do as much as I can for as long as I can to help people, to help the circumstance wherever I find myself. And Mom, I will continue to strive to improve, to work to become a better man.
Ambassador Lenhart, I just can't thank you enough for giving us this wonderful glimpse into your life of service and laying a roadmap for those who now come after you to follow and to emulate, so that we can continue this tradition in our country of being people of givers, people who put others before self. I am so grateful for your life. I'm so grateful for our friendship. And I wish you and your bride, Jackie, many more continued years of success and service.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to reflect on a career of service. But I also want to thank you for the work that you do, Art, with the Wise Giving Alliance. The work that you do, central to everything that I have thought about and the work that I do, because it inspires others to give and to operate in an environment that sees philanthropy done right and the standards that are set by the Wise Giving Alliance, and the opportunity to help philanthropic organizations be more than they could realize through their efforts, by making sure that the work is done efficiently, the work is done effectively, and the work is done to a standard that everyone expects, and in some cases, most cases, up to legal standards. So I just want to thank you for that. And so I'm going to hold up that reflective mirror and say to you, I appreciate everything that you do. And so whatever I've done in my career is with the opportunity, the object of which is to inspire as many people as I can to do more. And the Wise Giving Alliance is certainly doing more in our society and the world.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbsgive.org.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.